or moustache. Tilt your chin up, there. Do you have a shaving blade?
Only my knife, I admitted nervously.
We'll make do, then,
she said comfortingly. She walked to the door, flung it open, and used the power of a minstrel's lungs to bellow for the serving boy to bring her hot water and tea and bread and some rashers of bacon. And when she came into the room, she cocked her head and looked at me critically.
Let's cut your hair, too, she proposed. Take it down.
I moved too slowly to satisfy her. She stepped behind me, tugged off my kerchief, and freed my hair from the leather thong. Unbound, it fell to my shoulders. She took up her comb and curried my hair roughly forward.
Let's see,
she muttered, as I gritted my teeth to her rough combing.
What do you propose? I asked her, but hanks of hair were already falling to the floor.
Whatever she had decided was rapidly becoming a reality. She pulled hair forward over my face, then cut it off square above my eyebrows, tugged her comb through the rest of it a few times, then cut it off at jaw length.
Now, she told me, you look a bit more like Pharaoh Merchantstock. Before, you were obviously a buckman. Your colouring is still buck, but now your hair and clothes are Pharaoh. As long as you don't talk, folk won't be certain where you're from.
She considered a moment, then went to work again on the hair above my brow. After a moment, she rummaged around and gave me a mirror.
The white will be a lot less noticeable now.
She was right. She had trimmed out most of the white hair and pulled forward black hair to fall over the stubble. My beard now hugged my face as well. I nodded a grudging approval. There was a knock at the door.
Leave it outside!
Starling called through the door. She waited a few moments, then fetched in her breakfast and the hot water. She washed, then suggested I put a good edge on my knife while she ate. I did so, wondering as I honed the blade if I felt flattered or irritated at her refashioning of me. She was beginning to remind me of patience. She was still chewing as she came to take the knife from my hand. She swallowed, then spoke.
I'm going to give your beard a bit more shape. You'll have to keep it up, though. I'm not going to shave you every day, she warned me. Now, damp your face down well.
I was substantially more nervous as she brandished the knife, especially as she worked near my throat, but when she was finished and I took up the looking-glass, I was amazed at the changes she had wrought. She had defined my beard, confining it to my jaw and cheek. The square-cut hair hanging over my brow made my eyes look deeper. The scar on my cheek was still visible, but it followed the line of my moustache and was less noticeable. I ran my hand lightly over my beard, pleased with how much less of it there was.
It's quite a change, I told her.
It's a vast improvement, she told me.
I doubt that Crease or Dell would recognize you now. Let's just be rid of this.
She gathered up the hair cuttings and opened the window to fling them out onto the wind. Then she shut it and brushed off her hands.
Thank you, I said awkwardly.
You're welcome, she told me.
She glanced about the room and breathed a small sigh.
I'm going to miss that bed, she told me.
She set to packing with a swift efficiency. She caught me watching her and grinned.
When you're a minstrel who wanders, you learn to do this quickly and well.
She tossed in the last items, then laced her pack shut. She swung it to one shoulder.
Wait for me at the bottom of the back stairs, she commanded, while I go settle my bill.
I did as she bade me, but waited substantially longer in the cold and wind than I'd expected. Eventually she emerged, rosy-cheeked and ready for the day. She stretched herself like a wild cat.
This way, she directed me.
I had expected to shorten my stride to accommodate her, but found that we matched pace easily. She glanced across at me as we strode away from the merchant sector of town and headed to the northern outskirts.
You look different today, she informed me. And it's not just the haircut. You've made up your mind about something.
I have, I agreed with her.
Good,
she said warmly, and she took my arm companionably.
I hope it's to trust me. I glanced at her and said nothing. She laughed, but did not release my arm. The wooden walkways of the merchant's section of Blue Lake soon disappeared, and we walked in the street, past houses that huddled against each other as if seeking shelter from the cold. The wind was a constant chill push against us as we strode along cobbled streets that gave way eventually to roads of packed earth that ran past small farmsteads. The road was rutted and muddy from the rains of the last few days. This day, at least, was fair, even if the blustery wind was cold. "Is there much farther to go?" I finally asked of her.
"I'm not certain. I'm simply following directions. Watch for 3 stacked rocks at the side of the road."
"What do you really know of these smugglers?" I demanded. She shrugged a bit too casually.
"I know they are going to the mountains when no one else is, and I know they are taking the pilgrims with them."
"Pilgrims?"
"Or whatever you wish to call them. They go to Wanarida's shrine at the Mountain Kingdom. They had bought passage on a barge earlier in the summer, but then the King's Guard claimed all the barges for their own use and shut down the borders to the Mountain Kingdom. The pilgrims have been stuck in Blue Lake since then, trying to find a way to continue their journey."
We came to the 3 stacked rocks, and a weedy track through a rocky, brambly pasture surrounded by a rock-and-pole fence. A few horses were grazing disconsolately. I noted, with interest, they were mountain-bred, small and patchy-coated at this time of year. A little house was set well back from the road. It was built of river rock and mortar, with a sod roof. The small outbuilding behind it matched it. A thin trickle of smoke escaped its chimney to be swiftly dispersed by the wind. A man sat on the fence, whittling at something. He lifted his eyes to regard us and, evidently, decided we were no threat. He made no challenge to us as we passed him and went to the door of the cottage. Just outside the cottage, fat pigeons cooed and strutted in a cote. Starling knocked at the door, but the answer came from a man who walked around the corner of the house. He had rough brown hair and blue eyes, and was dressed like a farmer. He carried a brimming bucket of warm milk.
"Who do you seek?"
he greeted us.
"Nick,"
Starling replied.
"I know no Nick,"
the man said. He opened the door and went into the house. Starling boldly followed him, and I trailed her with less confidence. My sword was at my hip. I put my hand closer to the hilt, but not on it. I didn't want to provoke a challenge. Inside the hut, a driftwood fire burned in the hearth. Most, but not all, of the smoke was going up the chimney. A boy and a spotted kid shared a pile of straw in one corner. He regarded us with wide blue eyes, but said nothing. Smoked hams and sides hung low from the rafters. The man carried the milk to a table where a woman was chopping up fat yellow roots. He set the bucket down beside her and turned to us mildly.
"I think you've come to the wrong house. Try down the road a ways. Not the next house. That's where Pelf lives, but beyond, maybe."
"Thank you kindly, we shall."
Starling smiled round at them all and went to the door.
"Coming, Tom?"
she asked me. I nodded pleasantly at the folk and followed her. We left the house and walked up the lane. When we were well away, I asked her,
"Now what?"
"I'm not precisely sure. From what I overheard, I think we go to Pelf's house and ask for Nick."
"From what you overheard?"
"You don't think I have personal knowledge of smugglers, do you? I was in the public baths. 2 women were talking as they bathed. Pilgrims on their way to the mountains. One was saying it might be their last chance at a bath for a while, and the other was saying she didn't care as long as they finally got to leave Blue Lake. Then one told the other where they were supposed to meet the smugglers."
I said nothing. I suppose my expression said it all, for Starling asked me indignantly, "Do you have any better ideas? This will either work out or it won't."
"It may work out to us with our throats cut."
"Then go back to town and see if you can do better."
I think that if we did that, the man following us would decide we were certainly spies, and do more than just follow us. "Let us go on to Pelf and see what comes of it," No, don't look back. We returned to the road and walked to the next farmstead. The wind had become stronger and I tasted snow on it. If we did not find Nick soon, it was going to be a long, cold walk back to town. Someone had once cared about this next farm. Once there had been a line of silver birches to either side of the drive. Now, they were brittle scarecrows of trees, their branches long bare, bark peeling in the wind. A few survivors wept yellow coin leaves in the wind. Exclusive pastures and fields had been fenced, and whatever stock they had held was long gone. The weedy fields went unplanted, the thistly pastures ungrazed. "What happened to this land?" I demanded, as we walked past the desolation.
"Years of drought, then a summer of fire. Out beyond these farmsteads the riverbanks used to be covered with open oak forests and grazing land. Here, these were dairy farms. But out there, smallholders ran their goats in the free pasturage, and their harrigers scavenged under the oaks for corns. I have heard it was magnificent hunting as well. Then came the fire. It burned for over a month, they say, so that a man could scarcely breathe, and the river ran black with ash. Not just the forests and wild meadows, but hayfields and homes were torched by the flying sparks. After the years of drought, the river was no more than a trickle of itself. There was nowhere to flee from the fire, and after the fire came more hot, dry days. But the winds that blew carried dust now as well as ash, smaller streams choked with it. It blew until the rains finally came that fall. All the water that folk had prayed for years came in one season, floods of it. And when the water went down, well, you see what was left. Washed out, gravelly soil. I recall hearing something of the sort. It had been a conversation long ago. Someone, Chade, had told me that the people held the king accountable for everything, even droughts and fires. It had meant little to me then, but to these farmers it must have seemed like the end of the world. The house, too, spoke of a loving hand and better times. It was two stories, built of timber, but its paint was long faded. Shutters were closed tight over the windows in the upper story. There were two chimneys at either end of the house, but one was losing its stones. Smoke rose from the other one. A young girl stood before the door of the house. A fat grey pigeon perched on her hand as she was stroking it lightly.
"Good day,"
she bid us, in a pleasantly low voice as we approached. Her tunic was leather over a loose cream shirt of wool. She wore leather trousers as well, and boots. I put her age at about 12, and knew she was some kin to the folk in the other house by her eyes and hair.
"Good day,"
Starling returned to her.
"We are looking for Nick."
The girl shook her head.
"You have come to the wrong house. There is no Nick here. This is Pelf's house. Perhaps you should seek farther down the road."
She smiled at us, no more than puzzlement on her face. Starling gave me an uncertain glance. I took her arm. "We have been given poor directions. Come, let us take ourselves back to town and try again." At that time I hoped no more than to get ourselves out of the situation.
"But—"
she objected in confusion. I had a sudden inspiration.
"Shush.
We were warned these are not people to take lightly. The bird must have gone astray, or a hawk taken it. There is nothing more to be done here today."
"A bird?"
the girl piped suddenly. "Only a pigeon. Good day to you." I put my arm about Starling and turned her firmly. "We did not mean to bother you."
"Whose pigeon?"
I let my eyes meet hers for a moment. "A friend of Nick's. Do not let it concern you. Come, Starling."
"Wait,"
the girl said suddenly.
"My brother is inside. Perhaps he knows this Nick."
I would not wish to bother him, I assured her.
"No bother."
The bird on her hand stretched out his wings as she gestured to the front door with it.
"Come inside out of the cold for a bit."
"It is a cold day," I conceded.
I turned to confront the whittler, just as he was emerging from the line of birches. Perhaps we should all go inside.
Perhaps.
The girl grinned at my shadow's discomfiture. Within the door was a bare entry hall. The fine, inlaid wood of the floor was scuffed and had gone unoiled for some time. Lighter spaces on the walls showed where paintings and tapestries had once hung. A bare staircase led to the upper floor. There was no light, save what came in the thick windows. Inside, there was no wind, but it was not much warmer.
"Wait here,"
the girl told us, and entered a chamber to our right, closing the door firmly behind her. Starling stood a bit closer to me than I wished. The whittler watched us expressionlessly. Starling took a breath. "Hush," I told her before she could speak. Instead, she took my arm. I made the excuse of stooping to adjust my boot. As I straightened, I turned and put her on my left side. She immediately took hold of that arm. It seemed a very long time before the door opened. A tall man, brown-haired and blue-eyed, came out. He was dressed like the girl, in leathers. A very long knife hung at his belt. The girl came on his heels, looking petulant. He had rebuked her then. He scowled at us and demanded, "What's this about?" "My mistake, sir," I said immediately. "We were seeking one named Nick, and obviously we have come to the wrong house. Your pardon, sir." He spoke reluctantly. "I have a friend with a cousin named Nick. I could give word of you to him, perhaps." I squeezed Starling's hand for silence. "No, no. We wouldn't wish to trouble you, unless you'd like to tell us where we could find Nick himself." "I could take a message," he offered again, but it was not really an offer. I scratched at my beard and considered. "I've a friend whose cousin wished to send something across the river. He had heard that Nick might know someone who could take it for him. He promised my friend's cousin that he would send a bird, to let Nick know we were coming, for a fee, of course. That was all a paltry matter." He gave a slow nod. "I've heard of folks hereabouts who do such things. It's dangerous work, yes? Treasonous work, too. They'd pay with their heads if the King's Guard caught them." "That they would," I agreed readily. "But I doubt that my friend's cousin would do business with the kind of folk who'd get caught. That was why he was wishing to speak to Nick." "And who was it sent you here to seek this Nick?" "I forget," I said coolly. "I'm afraid I'm rather good at forgetting names."
"Are you?"
the man asked, consideringly. He glanced at his sister and gave a small nod.
"May I offer you some brandy?"
"That would be most welcome," I told him. I managed to pry my arm free of Starling as we entered the chamber. As the door shut behind us, Starling sighed in the welcome warmth. This room was as opulent as the other was bare. Rugs coated the floor, tapestries lined the walls. There was a heavy oak table with a branch of white candles for illumination. A fire blazed in the huge hearth before a half-circle of comfortable chairs. It was to this area our host led us. He snagged a glass decanter of brandy as he passed the table.
"Find some cups,"
he peremptorily ordered the girl. She seemed to take no offense at it. I guessed his age at about 25. Older brothers are not the kindest of heroes. She handed the whittler her pigeon and gestured both of them out before she went to find cups.
"Now, you were saying?"
he offered when we were settled before the fire.
"Actually, you were saying," I suggested.
He was silent as his sister came back with cups. He passed them to us as he filled them, and the four of us raised cups together.
"To King Regal,"
he suggested.
"To my king."
I offered affably and drank. It was good brandy. One Burrich would have appreciated.
"King Regal would see folk like our friend Nick swinging," the man suggested.
"Or more likely in his circle," I suggested. I gave a small sigh.
"It's a dilemma."
On the one hand, King Regal threatens his life. On the other hand, without King Regal's embargo on the mountains, what livelihood would Nick pursue? I heard all that his family's holdings grow these days is rocks. The man nodded in commiseration. Poor Nick. A man must do something to survive.
That he must.
I agreed.
And sometimes to survive, a man must cross a river.
Even if his king forbids it.
Must he?
The man asked.
Now that's a bit different from sending something across the river.
Not that different, I told him. If Nick is good at his trade, the one should no more tax him than the other. And I'd heard Nick was good.
The best,
the girl said with quiet pride. Her brother shot her a warning glance.
What would this man be offering to cross?
He asked quietly.
He'd offer it to Nick himself.
I said as softly. For a few breaths, the man looked into the fire. Then he stood and extended a hand.
Nick Holdfast.
My sister Pelf.
Tom, I said.
Starling,
the minstrel added. Nick held his cup aloft again.
To a bargain in the making,
he suggested, and again we drank. He sat and asked immediately,
shall we speak plainly?
I nodded. The plainest possible.
We had heard that you were taking a group of pilgrims over the river and across the border into the mountain kingdom. We seek the same service.
At the same price. Starling chimed in smoothly.
Nick, I don't like this.
Pelf broke in suddenly.
Someone's tongue has been wagging too freely. I knew we should never have agreed to the first lot. How do we know?
Hush. I'm the one taking the risks. So I'll be the one to say what I will or will not do. You've naught to do but wait here and mind things while I'm gone, and see that your own tongue doesn't wag.
He turned back to me.
It will be a gold each up front,
and another on the other side of the river, a third at the mountain border.
Ah.
The price was shocking.
We can't...
Starling dug her nails suddenly into my wrist. I shut my mouth.
You will never convince me the pilgrims paid that much,
Starling said quietly.
They have their own horses and wagons, food supplies too.
He cocked his head at us.
But you look to be folk travelling with what's on your backs and no more.
And a lot easier to conceal than a wagon and team.
We'll give you one gold now, and one at the mountain border, for both of us,
Starling offered. He leaned back in his chair and pondered a moment. Then he poured more brandy all round.
Not enough, he said regretfully, but I suspect it's all you have.
It was more than I had. I hoped, perhaps, it was what Starling had.
Take us over the river for that much, I offered.
From there we're on our own. Starling kicked me under the table. She seemed to be speaking only to me as she said,
he's taking the others to the mountain border and across it. We may as well enjoy the company that far.
She turned back to Nick.
It will have to take us all the way to the mountains.
Nick sipped at his brandy. He sighed heavily.
I'll see your coin, begging your pardon, before we say it's a bargain.
Starling and I exchanged glances.
We'll require a private moment, she said smoothly.
Begging your pardon?
She rose and, taking my hand, led me to the corner of the room.
Once there, she whispered, have you never bargained before in your life? You give too much, too fast. Now, how much coin do you truly have?
For answer, I upended my purse in my hand. She picked through the contents as swiftly as a magpie stealing grain. She hefted the coins in her hand with a practiced air.
We're short. I thought you'd have more than this. What's that?
Her finger jabbed at Burridge's earring. I closed my hand around it before she could pick it up. Something very important to me.
More important than your life?
Not quite, I admitted. But close.
My father wore it, for a time.
A close friend of his gave it to me.
Well, if it must go, I'll see that it goes dearly.
She turned away from me without another word and walked back to Nick. She took her seat, tossed the rest of her brandy down, and waited for me. When I was seated, she told Nick, "We'll give you what coin we have now. It's not as much as you ask, but at the mountain border, I'll give you all my jewelry as well, rings, earrings, all of it. What do you say?"
He shook his head slowly. "It's not enough for me to risk hanging over."
"What's the risk?" Starling demanded. "If they discover you with the pilgrims, you'll hang. You've already been paid for that risk, in what they gave you. We don't increase your risk, only your supply burden. Surely it's worth that."
He shook his head, almost reluctantly. Starling turned and held out her hand to me.
"Show it to him," she said quietly.
I felt almost sick as I opened my pouch and fingered out the earring. "What I have might not seem like much at first glance," I told him. "Unless a person were knowledgeable about such things, I am. I know what I have and I know what it's worth. It's worth whatever trouble you'd have to go through for us." I spread it out on my palm. The fine silver net trapping the sapphire within. Then I picked it up by the pin and held it before the dancing fire. "It's not just the silver or the sapphire. It's the workmanship. Look how supple is the silver net. See how fine the links." Starling reached one fingertip to touch it. "King-in-waiting chivalry once owned it," she added respectfully.
"Coins are more easily spent,"
Nick pointed out. I shrugged. "If coins to spend are all a man wants, that is true. Sometimes there is pleasure in the owning of something, pleasure greater than coins in the pocket. But when it is yours, you could change it for coins, if you wished. Were I to attempt it now, in haste, I'd get but a fraction of its worth. But a man with your connections and the time to bargain well could get well over 4 golds for it. But if you'd rather, I could go back to town with it and—" Greed had kindled in his eyes.
"I'll take it,"
he conceded. "On the other side of the river," I told him. I lifted the jewelry and restored it to my ear. Let him look at it each time he looked at me. I made it formal. "You undertake to get us both safely to the other side of the river, and when we get there, the earring is yours." "As your sole payment," Starling added quietly, "though we will allow you to hold all our coins until then, as a surety."
"Agreed. And here's my hand on it,"
he acknowledged. We shook hands.
"When do we leave?"
I asked him.
"When the weather's right,"
he said. "Tomorrow would be better," I told him. He rose, slowly.
"Tomorrow, eh? Well, if the weather's right tomorrow, then is when we'll leave. Now I've a few things I need to attend to. I'll have to excuse myself, but Pelf can see to you here."
I had expected to walk back to town for the night, but Starling bargained with Pelf, her songs for a meal for us, and then to prepare us a room for the night. I was a bit ill at ease to sleep among strangers, but reflected it might actually be safer than going back to town. If the food Pelf cooked for us was not as fine as we had enjoyed at Starling's inn the night before, it was still far better than onion and potato soup. There were thick slices of fried ham and applesauce, and a cake made with fruits and seeds and spices. Pelf brought us beer to go with it, and joined us at table, speaking casually of general topics. After we'd eaten, Starling played a few songs for the girl, but I found I could scarcely keep my eyes open. I asked to be shown to a room, and Starling said she, too, was weary. Pelf showed us to a chamber above Nick's elaborate room. It had been a very fine room, once, but I doubted it had been regularly used for many years. She had started a fire in the hearth there, but the long chill of disuse and the must of neglect still filled the room. There was an immense bed with a feather bed on it, and greying hangings. Starling sniffed critically at it, and as soon as Pelf left, she busied herself in draping the blankets from the bed over a bench and setting it by the fire.
"They will both air and warm that way," she told me knowledgeably. I had been barring the door and checking the latches on the windows and shutters. They all seemed sound. I was suddenly too weary to reply. I told myself it was the brandy, followed by the beer. I dragged one chair to wedge it against the door, while Starling watched me with amusement. Then I came back to the fire and sank down onto the blanket-draped bench and stretched my legs to the warmth. I towed my boots off. Well, tomorrow I'd be on my way to the mountains. Starling came to sit beside me. For a time she didn't speak. Then she lifted a finger and batted at my earring with it. "Was it truly chivalry's?" she asked me. "For a while. And you'd give it up to get to the mountains. What would he say?" "Don't know, never knew the man." I suddenly sighed. By all accounts he was fond of his little brother. I don't think he'd begrudge me spending it to get to Verity.
"Then you do go to seek out your king?"
"Of course."
I tried in vain to stifle a yawn. Somehow it seemed foolish to deny it now. I'm not sure it was wise to mention chivalry to Nick. He might make a connection. I turned to look at her. Her face was too close. I couldn't bring her features into focus.
"But I'm too sleepy to care,"
I added.
"You've no head for Mary, bud,"
she laughed. "There was no smoke tonight."
"In the cake. She told you it was spiced."
"Is that what she meant?"
"Yes. That's what spiced means all over Faro."
"Oh. In bucket means there's ginger. Or citron."
"I know that."
She leaned against me and sighed.
"You don't trust these people, do you?"
"Of course not. They don't trust us. If we trusted them, they'd have no respect for us. They'd think us gullible fools, the sort who get smugglers into trouble by talking too much."
"But you shook hands with Nick."
"I did. And I believe he will keep his word, as far as it goes." We both fell silent, thinking about that. After a time I started awake again. Starling sat up beside me.
"I'm going to bed,"
she announced.
"Me too,"
I replied. I claimed a blanket and started to roll up in it by the fire.
"Don't be ridiculous,"
she told me.
"That bed's big enough for four. Sleep in a bed while you can, for I bet we aren't going to see another one soon."
I took very little persuading. The feather bed was deep, if a trifle smelly from damp. We each had a share of the blankets. I knew I should retain some caution, but the brandy and the Marybud had unloosed the knot of my will. I fell into a very deep sleep. Toward morning, I awoke once when Starling threw an arm over me. The fire had burned out and the room was cold. In her sleep she had migrated across the bed and was pressed up against my back. I started to ease away from her, but it was too warm and companionable. Her breath was against the back of my neck. There was a woman smell to her that was not a perfume, but a part of her. I closed my eyes and lay very still. Molly. The sudden, desperate longing I felt for her was like pain. I clenched my teeth to it. I willed myself into sleep again. It was a mistake. The baby was crying. Crying and crying. Molly was in her nightrobe with a blanket draped over her shoulders. She looked haggard and weary as she sat by the fire and rocked her endlessly. Molly sang a little song to her, over and over, but the tune had long since gone out of it. She turned her head slowly to the door as Burrich opened it.
"May I come in?"
he asked quietly. She nodded him in.
"What are you doing awake at this hour?"
she asked him tiredly.
"I could hear her crying out there. Is she ill?"
He went to the fire and poked it up a little. He added another piece of wood, then stooped to look in the baby's small face.
"I don't know. She just cries and cries and cries. She doesn't even want to nurse. I don't know what's wrong with her.
There was misery in Molly's voice, far past the use of tears. Burridge turned to her.
"Let me take her for a while. You go lie down and try to rest a bit, or you'll both be ill. You can't do this night after night."
Molly looked up at him without comprehension.
"You want to take care of her? You truly do that?"
"I may as well," he told her wryly. "I can't sleep through her crying."
Molly stood up as if her back ached.
"Warm yourself first. I'll make some tea."
For answer, he took the babe from her arms.
"No. You go back to bed for a while. No sense in all of us not sleeping."
Molly seemed unable to grasp it.
"You truly don't mind if I go back to bed?"
"No, go ahead. We'll be fine. Go on now."
He settled the blanket about her and then set the infant to his shoulder. She looked very tiny with his dark hands against her. Molly walked slowly across the room. She looked back at Burridge, but he was looking into the baby's face.
"Hush now,"
he told her.
"Hush."
Molly clambered into bed and pulled the blankets up over herself. Burridge did not sit down. He stood before the fire, rocking slightly on his feet as he patted the baby's back slowly.
"Burridge?"
Molly called to him quietly.
"Yes?"
He did not turn to look at her.
"There's no sense in your sleeping in that shed in this weather. You should move inside for the winter and sleep by the hearth."
"Oh, well, it's not so very cold out there. It's all in what you're used to, you know."
A small silence fell. "Burridge, I would feel safer were you closer."
Molly's voice was very small.
"Oh. Well, then I suppose I shall be. But there's nothing you need fear tonight. Go to sleep now, both of you."
He bent his head and I saw his lips brush the top of the baby's head.
Very softly he began to sing to her. I tried to make out the words, but his voice was too deep, nor did I know the language.
The baby's wailing became less determined. He began to pace slowly around the room with her, back and forth before the fire. I was with Molly as she watched him until she, too, fell asleep to Burridge's soothing voice. The only dream I had after that was of a lone wolf, running. Endlessly running. He was alone as I was.
15. Kettle. Queen Ketrigan was carrying Verity's child when she fled King-in-Waiting Regal to return to her mountains. Some have criticized her, saying if she had remained at Buck and forced Regal's hand, the child would have been born safely there. But if she had, Buckkeep Castle would have rallied to her. Perhaps all of Buck Duchy would have presented a more unified resistance to the Out-Islander raiders. Perhaps the coastal duchies would have fought harder if they had had a queen at Buck. So some say. The general belief of those who lived in Buckkeep Castle at the time and were well informed of the internal politics of the Farseer Regency is very different. Without exception, they believed that both Ketrigan and her unborn child would have met with foul play. It can be substantiated that even after Queen Ketrigan had removed herself from Buckkeep, those who supported Regal as king did all they could to discredit her, even to saying that the child she carried was not Verity's at all, but had been fathered by his bastard nephew, Fitzchivalry. Whatever suppositions might be made about what would have happened if Ketrigan had remained at Buckkeep are but useless speculations now. The historical fact is that she believed her child would have the best chance of surviving if born in her beloved mountain kingdom. She also returned to the mountains in the hope of being able to find Verity and restore her husband to power. Her search efforts, however, only yielded her grief. She found the battle site of his companions against unidentified attackers. The unburied remains were little more than scattered bones and draggled bits of clothing after the scavengers had finished with them. Among those remains, however, she found the blue cloak Verity had worn when she had last seen him, and his sheath knife. She returned to the royal residence at Jumpy
and mourned her husband as dead. More distressing to her was that for months afterwards she received reports of sightings of folk in the garb of Verity's guard in the mountains beyond Jampe. These individual guards were seen wandering alone by mountain villagers. They seemed reluctant to have conversation with the villagers and, despite their ragged condition, often refused offers of aid or food. Without exception, they were described by those who saw them as pathetic or piteous. Some few of these men trickled into Jampe from time to time. They seemed unable to answer her questions about Verity and what had become of him coherently. They could not even recall when they had parted company with him or under what circumstances. Without exception, they seemed almost obsessed with returning to Buck Keep. In time, she came to believe that Verity and his guard had been attacked, not only physically but by magic. The ambushers who struck at him with arrow and sword, and the false coterie that disheartened and confused his guard were, she surmised, in the employ of his younger brother, Prince Regal. This is what precipitated her unceasing ill will toward her brother-in-law. I awoke to a hammering at the door. I shouted something back as I sat up disoriented and cold in the dark. "We leave in an hour," was the reply. I found my way clear of weltering blankets and Starling's sleepy embrace. I found my boots and pulled them on, and then my cloak. I snugged it around me against the chilly room. Starling's only move had been to immediately burrow into the warm place where I had lain. I leaned over the bed. "Starling." When there was no response, I reached down and shook her slightly. "Starling, we leave in less than an hour. Get up." She heaved a tremendous sigh.
"Go ahead, I'll be ready."
She shouldered deeper into the blankets. I shrugged my shoulders and left her there. Downstairs in the kitchen, Pelf had stacks of griddle cakes, keeping warm by the cooking hearth. She offered me a plate with butter and honey, and I was only too glad to accept. The house, so quiet a place the day before, was now thronged with folk. From the strong resemblance, this was a family business. The small boy with the spotted kid was sitting at a stool by the table, feeding the goat bits of griddle cake. From time to time I caught him staring at me. When I smiled back, the boy's eyes got wide. With a serious expression he arose and carried his plate off, with the goat skittering after him. Nick strode through the kitchen, black wool cloak swirling about his calves. It was dotted with fresh snowflakes. He caught my eye in passing. "Ready to go?" I gave a nod. "Good." He gave me a glance on his way out. "Dress warmly. Storm is just beginning." He grinned. "Perfect travelling weather for you and me." I told myself I had not expected to enjoy the trip. I had finished my breakfast before Starling came down the stairs. When she reached the kitchen, she surprised me. I had expected her to be sleepy. Instead, she was brightly alert, her cheeks flushed and mouth laughing. As she came into the kitchen, she was trading quips with one of the men and getting the best of it. She did not hesitate when she got to the table, but helped herself to a hearty serving of everything. When she looked up from her empty plate, she must have seen the surprise on my face. "Minstrels learn to eat well when food is offered," she said, and held her cup out to me. She was drinking beer with her breakfast. I filled her cup from the pitcher on the table. She had just set her mug down with a sigh when Nick came through the kitchen, looking like a storm cloud. He caught sight of me and stopped in mid-stride.
Tom, can you drive a horse?"
"Certainly."
"Well?"
"Well enough," I said quietly.
"Good. Then we're ready to go. My cousin Hank was to drive, but he's breathing like a bellows this morning, took a cough in the night. His wife won't let him go, but if you can drive a cart—"
"He'll expect you to adjust your fee." Starling broke in instantly. "By driving a horse for you, he saved you the cost of a horse for himself, and what your cousin would have eaten." Nick was taken aback for a moment. He glanced from Starling to me. "Fair is fair," I observed. I tried not to smile.
"I'll make it right," he conceded,
and hastened out of the kitchen again. In a short time he was back. "The old woman says she'll try you. It's her horse and wagon, you see."
It was still dark outside. Torches spluttered in the wind and snow. Folk hurried about, hoods up and cloaks well fastened. There were four wagons and teams. One was full of people, about 15 of them. They huddled together, bags on their laps, heads bowed against the cold. A woman glanced toward me. Her face was full of apprehension. At her side, a child leaned against her. I wondered where they had all come from. Two men loaded a cask into the last wagon, then stretched a canvas over the whole load. Behind the wagon, loaded with passengers, was a smaller two-wheeled cart. A little old woman, swathed all in black, sat erect in the seat. She was well bundled in cloak, hood, and shawl, and a travelling blanket thrown across her knees as well. Her sharp black eyes watched me carefully as I walked around her rig. The horse was a speckled mare. She didn't like the weather, and her harness was binding her. I adjusted it as best as I could, persuading her to trust me. When I was finished, I looked up to find the old woman watching me closely. Her hair was glistening black where it peeped from her hood, but not all of the white in it was snow. She pursed her lips at me but said nothing, even when I stowed my pack under the seat. I gave her good day as I climbed up on the seat beside her and took up the reins. "I think I'm supposed to be driving for you," I said genially.
"You think? Don't you know?"
She peered at me sharply. "Hank has been taken ill. Nick asked if I would drive your mare. My name is Tom."
"I don't like changes," she told me, "especially not at the last minute. Changes say you weren't really ready in the first place, and now you're even less ready."
I suspected I knew why Hank was suddenly feeling poorly. "My name is Tom." I introduced myself again.
"You already said that,"
she informed me. She stared off into the falling snow.
"This old trip was a bad idea,"
she said aloud, "but not to me.
And no good is going to come of it. I can see that right now."
She kneaded her gloved hands in her lap.
"Damn old bones," she said to the falling snow. "If it weren't for my old bones, I'd not need a one of you. Not a one."
I could think of nothing to reply to that, but was saved by Starling. She reined in beside me.
"Will you look at what they've given me to ride?"
she challenged me. Her mount shook her black mane and rolled her eyes at me, as if demanding that I look at what she was expected to carry. "Looks fine to me. She's mountain stock. They're all like that. But she'll go all day for you, and most of them have sweet tempers." Starling scowled.
"I told Nick that for what we're paying I expected a proper horse."
Nick rode past us at that moment. His mount was no larger than Starling's. He looked at her and then away, as if weary of her tongue.
"Let's go,"
he said in a quietly carrying voice.
"It's better not to talk, and it's best to stay close to the wagon in front of you. It's easier to lose sight of each other in this storm than you might think."
For all his soft voice, the command was instantly obeyed. There was no shouted commands nor calls of farewell. Instead, the wagons in front of us rolled silently away from us. I stirred the reins and clucked to the horse. The mare gave a snort of disapproval, but stepped out to the pace. We moved forward in near silence through a perpetual curtain of falling snow. Starling's pony tugged relentlessly at her bit until Starling gave her her head. Then she trotted swiftly up to join the other horses at the front of the group. I was left sitting by the silent old woman. I soon found the truth to Nick's warning. The sun came up, but the snow continued to fall so thickly the light seemed milky. There was a mother-of-pearl quality to the swirling snow that both dazzled and wearied the eye. It seemed an endless tunnel of white that we travelled through, with only the tail of the other wagon to guide us. Nick did not take us by the road. We went crunching off across the frozen fields. The thickly fallen snow soon filled in the tracks we left. In no time, there would be no trace of our passage.
We travelled cross-country until past noon, with the riders dismounting to take down fence railings and then restoring them in our wake. I glimpsed another farmhouse once through the swirling storm, but its windows were dark. Shortly after midday, a final fence was opened for us. With a creak and a jolt, we came out of the field onto what had once been a road, but was now little more than a trail. The only tracks on it were those we made ourselves, and the snow swiftly erased those. And all that way my companion had been as chilly and silent as the falling snow itself. From time to time I watched her from the corner of my eye. She stared straight ahead, her body swaying to the motion of the wagon. She kneaded her hands restlessly in her lap as if they pained her. With little else to amuse myself, I spied upon her. Buck stock, obviously. The accent of my home was on her tongue still, though faded by many years of travel in other places. Her headscarf was the work of Chalced weavers, but the embroidery along the edges of her cloak, done black on black, was totally unfamiliar to me.
"You're a long way from Buck, boy,"
she observed abruptly. She stared straight ahead as she said it. Something about her tone set my back up. "As are you, old woman?" I replied. She turned her whole face to look at me. I was not sure if I glimpsed amusement or annoyance in her bright crow eyes.
"That I am. Years and distance alike, a long way."
She paused, then asked abruptly,
"Why are you bound for the mountains?"
"I want to see my uncle," I replied truthfully. She gave a snort of disdain.
"A buck boy has an uncle in the mountains, and you want to see him enough to put your head at risk?"
I looked over at her. "He's my favorite uncle. You, I understand, go to Ida's shrine."
"The others do,"
she corrected me.
"I'm too old to pray for fertility. I seek a prophet."
Before I could speak, she added,
"He's my favorite prophet."
Almost, she smiled at me. "Why don't you travel with the others in the wagon?" I asked her. She gave me a chill look.
"They ask too many questions,"
she replied.
"Ah,"
I said, and grinned at her, accepting the rebuke. After a few moments she spoke again.
"I've been a long time on my own, Tom. I like to go my own way and keep my own counsel and decide for myself what I'll eat for my supper. Those ones, they're nice enough folk, but they scratch and peck like a flock of chickens. Left to themselves, not a one of them would make this journey alone. They all need the others to say, 'Yes, yes, this is what we should be doing, it's worth the risk.' And now that they've decided it, the decision is bigger than all of them. Not a one of them could turn back on their own."
She shook her head at that, and I nodded thoughtfully. She said nothing more for a long time. Our trail had found the river. We followed it upstream, through a scanty cover of brush and very young trees. I could scarcely see it through the steadily falling snow, but I could smell it and hear the rush of its passage. I wondered how far we'd go before we tried to cross it. Then I grinned to myself. I was certain Starling would know when I saw her this evening. I wondered if Nick was enjoying her company.
"What are you smirking about?"
the old woman demanded suddenly. I was thinking on my friend the minstrel, Starling.
"And she makes you smile like that?"
"Sometimes."
"She's a minstrel, you say. And you? Are you a minstrel?"
"No. Just a shepherd, most of the time."
"I see."
Our talk died off again. Then, as evening began to fall, she told me,
"You may call me Kettle."
"I'm Tom," I replied.
"And that's the third time you've told me,"
she reminded me. I had expected we would camp at nightfall, but Nick kept us moving. We halted briefly while he took out two lanterns and hung them from a couple of the wagons.
"Just follow the light,"
he told me tersely, as he rode past us. Our mare did just that. The light was gone, and the cold getting intense when the wagon in front of us turned off the road and jolted into an opening in the trees by the river. Obediently I turned our mare to follow, and we bumped down off the road with a thud that made Kettle curse. I smiled. There were few Buckkeep guardsmen who could have done better. In a short time we halted. I kept to my seat, wondering, for I could not see a thing. The river was a black, sweeping force somewhere to our left. The wind off it added a new note of damp to the cold. The pilgrims in the wagon ahead of us were shifting restlessly and talking in soft whispers. I heard Nick's voice speaking and saw a man lead his horse past us. He took the lantern from the tail of the wagon as he went by. I followed its passage. In a moment, man and horse had passed into a long, low building that had been invisible in the dark.
"Get down, go inside, we'll spend the night here,"
Nick instructed as he rode past us again. I dismounted, and then went to help Kettle down. As I offered her my hand, she looked almost startled.
"I thank you, kind sir,"
she said quietly, as I helped her down. "You're welcome, my lady," I replied. She took my arm as I guided her toward the building.
"Pretty damn well-mannered for a shepherd, Tom,"
she observed in an entirely different voice. She gave a snort of laughter at the door and went inside, leaving me to go back and unhitch the mare. I shook my head at myself, but had to smile. I liked this old woman. I slung my pack over my shoulder and led the mare into the building where the others had gone. As I lifted her harness from her, I glanced around. It was one long, open room. A fire had been kindled in a hearth at one end. The low-ceilinged building was of river rock and clay, with an earthen floor. The horses were at one end, crowding around a manger full of hay. As I turned our mare in with the others, one of Nick's men came bringing buckets of water to fill a trough. The depth of manure at that end of the room told me this building was frequently used by the smugglers. "What was this place originally?" I asked Nick as I joined the others around the hearth. "Sheep camp," he told me. "The shelter was for the early lambing. Then later, we'd shear here, after we'd washed the sheep in the river." His blue eyes were afar for a time. Then he gave a harsh laugh.
"That was a long time ago. Now there's not enough feed for a goat, let alone sheep like we had."
He gestured at the fire.
"Best eat and sleep all you can, Tom. Morning comes early for us."
His glance seemed to linger on my earring as he passed me. Food was simple. Bread and smoked fish, porridge, hot tea. Most of it was from the pilgrims' supplies, but Nick put in enough that they did not object to feeding his men and Starling and me. Kettle ate by herself, from her own stores, and brewed her own pot of tea. The other pilgrims were polite to her, and she was courteous in return, but there was plainly no bond between them, save that they were all going to the same place. Only the three children of the party seemed unafraid of her, begging dried apples and stories from her, until she warned them they would all be sick. The shelter soon warmed, from the horses and folk in it as much as from the hearth. Door and window shutters were closed tight, to keep in light and sound as well as warmth. Despite the storm and lack of other travellers on our path, Nick was taking no chances. I approved of that in a smuggler. The meal had given me my first good look at the company. 15 pilgrims, of mixed age and gender, not counting Kettle. About a dozen smugglers, of whom 6 had enough resemblance to Nick and Pelf that they were at least cousins. The others looked like a mixed bunch, professionally tough and watchful. At least 3 were on watch at all times. They spoke little and knew their tasks well enough that Nick directed them very little. I found myself feeling confident that I would see at least the other side of the river, and probably the mountain border. It was the most optimistic I'd felt in a long time. Starling showed to her best advantage in such company. As soon as we had eaten, she took out her harp, and despite Nick's frequent cautions to us to speak softly, he did not forbid the soft music and song she gave us. For the smugglers, she sang an old ballad about Heft the Highwayman, probably the most dashing robber that Buck had ever known. Even Nick was smiling at that song. and Starling's eyes flirted with him as she sang. To the pilgrims she sang about a winding river road that carried folk home and finished with a lullaby for the three children in our midst. By then, more than just the children were stretched out on bedrolls. Kettle had peremptorily sent me out to fetch hers from the back of her cart. I wondered when I had been promoted from driver to servant, but said nothing as I fetched it for her. I supposed there was something about me that made all elderly folk assume my time was at their disposal. I unrolled my own blankets next to Kettle's and lay down to seek sleep. Around me, most of the others were already snoring. Kettle curled in her blankets like a squirrel in its nest. I could imagine how much her bones ached with the cold, but there was little I could do for her. Over by the hearth, Starling sat talking to Nick. From time to time her fingers wandered lightly over her harp strings, their silvery notes a counterpoint to her low voice. Several times, she made Nick laugh. I was almost asleep.
"My brother!"
My whole body jerked with the shock of it. He was near. "Night-Eyes?"
"Of course."
Amusement.
"Or do you have another brother now?"
"Never. Only you, my friend. Where are you?"
"Where am I? Outside. Come to me."
I rose hastily and redonned my cloak. The man guarding the door frowned at me, but asked me no questions. I walked into the darkness, beyond the pulled-up wagons. The snow had ceased, and the blowing wind had cleared a patch of starlit sky. Snow silvered the branches of every bush and tree. I was casting about for his presence when a solid weight hit me in the back. I was flung face first in the snow, and would have cried out, save that my mouth was full of snow. I managed to roll over and was trampled several times by a joyous wolf.
"How did you know where to find me? How do you know where to scratch when it itches?"
I suddenly knew what he meant. I was not always aware of our bond, but to think of him now and to find him was suddenly no more difficult than to bring my two hands together in the dark. Of course I knew where he was. He was a part of me.
"You smell like a female. You have taken a new mate?"
"No, of course not."
"But you share a den."
"We travel together, as a pack. It is safer so."
"I know."
For a time, we sat in stillness of mind and body, simply adjusting to one another's physical presence again. I felt whole once more. I had peace. I had not known I had worried so much about him until the sight of him put my mind at rest. I sensed his unwilling agreement to that. He knew I had faced hardship and dangers alone. He had not thought I could survive them. But he had also missed me. He had missed my form of thinking, the sorts of ideas and discussions that wolves never share amongst themselves.
"Is that why you came back to me?"
I asked him. He stood up suddenly and shook himself all over.
"It was time to come back,"
he replied evasively. Then he added,
"I ran with them. They finally allowed me to be part of their pack. We hunted together, we killed together, we shared meat. It was very good.
But
I wanted to be the leader."
He turned and looked at me over his shoulder, his tongue lolling out.
"I am used to being the leader, you know."
"Are you? And they would not accept you?"
"Black Wolf is very large and quick. I am stronger than he is, I think, but he knows more tricks. It was much like when you fought Heart of the Pack."
I laughed quietly, and he spun on me, lifting his lips in a mock snarl.
"Be easy,"
I said quietly, warding him off with open hands.
"So, what happened?"
He flung himself down beside me.
"He is still the leader. He still has the mate and the den."
He considered, and I sensed him wrestling with the concept of the future.
"It could be different. Another time."
"It could be. I agreed. I scratched him gently behind the ear, and he all but fell over in the snow.
"Will you go back, then, some day?"
He was having difficulty focusing on my words while I scratched his ears. I stopped and asked him again. He cocked his head to one side and regarded me with amusement.
"Ask me on the Sunday, and I will be able to answer."
"One day at a time." I agreed with him.
"I am glad you are here. But I still don't understand why you came back to me. You could have stayed with the pack."
His eyes met mine, and even in the darkness they gripped me.
"You are called, are you not? Did not your king howl to you, 'Come to me'?"
I nodded unwillingly.
"I am called."
He stood suddenly, shook himself all over. He looked off into the night.
"If you are called, I am called too."
He did not admit it, willingly.
"You do not have to come with me. This call from my king binds me, not you." "In that, you are wrong. What binds you binds me."
"I do not understand how that could be," I said carefully.
"Nor do I, but it is so. Come to me," he called to us, and for a time I could ignore it. "But no more.
I am sorry." I groped for a way to express it. "He has no right to you, I know that. I do not think he intended to call you. I do not think he intended to bind me, but it happened, and I must go to him." I stood up and dusted off the snow that was starting to melt on me.
I felt ashamed.
Verity, a man whom I trusted, had done this to me. That was bad enough. But through me it was imposed on the wolf. Verity had no right to put any demands on Nighteyes. For that matter, I had no right to put any demands on him. What had been between us had always been entered into voluntarily, a mutual giving on both sides with no laying on of obligations. Now, through me, he was entrapped as surely as if I had caged him.
"We share a cage, then."
"I wish it were otherwise. I wish there were some way I could free you of this. But I do not even know how to free myself. Not knowing how you are bound, I do not know how to loose you.
You and I, we share the wit.
Verity and I share the skill.
How could his skill-sending have gone through me to seize you? You were not even with me when he summoned me."
Nighteyes sat very still in the snow. The wind had come up, and in the faint starlight I could see it ruffling his coat.
"I am always with you, brother. You may not always be aware of me, but I am always with you. We are one."
"We share many things," I agreed. Uneasiness itched at me.
"No."
He turned to face me squarely, met my eyes as no wild wolf would have.
"We do not share. We are one. I am no longer a wolf. You are no longer a man. What we are together, I have no name for. Perhaps the one who spoke to us of the old blood would have a word to explain it."
He paused.
"See how much a man I am, that I speak of having a word for an idea. No word is needed. We exist. And we are whatever we are.
I would set you free if I could."
"Would you? I would not part from you."
"That is not what I meant. I meant I would have for you a life of your own." He yawned, then stretched.
"I will have for us a life of our own.
We shall win it together. So, do we travel by night or by day?"
"We travel by day." He sensed what I meant.
"You will stay with this huge pack to travel. Why not break free of it and run with me? We shall go faster."
I shook my head. "It is not that simple. To travel where we must, I will need shelter, and I have none that is mine alone. I need the aid of this pack to survive in this weather." There followed a difficult half hour, as I tried to explain to him that I would need the support of the others in the caravan to reach the mountains. Had I had a horse and provisions of my own, I would not have hesitated to trust to luck and strike out with the wolf. But on foot, with only what I could carry myself, facing the deep snows and deeper cold of the mountains, not to mention a river crossing, I would not be that great a fool.
"We could hunt," Night Eyes insisted. "We could curl together in the snow at night."
He could take care of me as he always had. With persistence, I was able to convince him that I must continue to travel as I did.
"Then I shall have to continue to sneak along like a stray dog, following all these folk."
"Tom! Tom, are you out there?"
There was irritated annoyance and worry in Nick's voice.
"Right here."
I stepped out of the bushes.
"What were you doing?"
he demanded suspiciously.
"Pissing,"
I told him. I made a sudden decision. "And my dog has followed me from town and caught up with us here. I left him with friends, but he must have chewed his rope. Here, boy, come to heel."
"I'll chew your heel off for you,"
Night Eyes offered savagely, but he came, following me out into the cleared yard.
"Damn big dog," Nick observed.
He leaned forward.
"Looks more than half a wolf to me."
"Some in Pharaoh have told me that. It's a buck breed. We use them for herding sheep."
"You will pay for this, I promise you."
In answer, I leaned down to pat his shoulder and then scratch his ears.
"Wag your tail, Night Eyes."
"He's a loyal old dog. I should have known he wouldn't be left behind."
"The things I endure for you."
He wagged his tail. Once.
"I see. Well, you'd best get yourself inside and get some sleep. And next time, don't go off by yourself for anything. At least not without letting me know first. When my men are on watch, they get jumpy. They might cut your throat before they knew you."
"I understand."
"I walked right past two of them."
Nick, you don't mind, do you? The dog, I mean." I tried to act affably abashed. "He can stay outside. He's a real good watchdog, actually."
"Just don't expect me to feed him for you," Nick growled. "And don't let him be any trouble to us."
"Oh, I'm sure he won't. Will you, boy?" Starling chose that moment to come to the door.
"Nick? Tom?"
"We're right here."
"You were right. He was just pissing," Nick said quietly.
He took Starling's arm and began to guide her back into the shed.
"What's that?"
she demanded, sounding almost alarmed. I suddenly had to wager everything on her quick wits and our friendship.
"Just the dog," I said quickly.
"Night Eyes must have chewed his rope. I warned Kreese to watch him when I left him there, that he'd want to follow me, but Kreese didn't listen, and here he is. I guess I'll have to take him to the mountains with us after all." Starling was staring at the wolf. Her eyes were as wide and black as the night sky above us. Nick tugged at her arm, and she finally turned back to the door.
"I suppose so,"
she said faintly. I suddenly thanked Ida and any other god that might be listening. To Night Eyes I said, "Stay in guard. There's a good fellow.
Enjoy it while you can, little brother."
He flung himself down by the cart. I doubted that he'd stay there for more than a few heartbeats. I followed Starling and Nick inside. Nick shut the door firmly behind us and dropped the bolt in place. I pulled off my boots and shook out my snow-laden cloak before I wrapped myself in my blankets. Sleep was suddenly very close as I grasped the full relief I felt.
Night Eyes was back.
I felt whole, safe, with the wolf at the door.
"Night Eyes, I'm glad you're here."
"You've an odd way of showing it,"
he replied, but I could sense he was more amused than upset.
"Black Rolf sent me a message. Regal seeks to turn those of old blood against us. He offers them gold to hunt us down for him. We should not speak overly much."
"Gold?" What is gold to us or those like us? Do not fear, little brother. I am here to take care of you again.
I closed my eyes and sank into sleep, hoping he was right. For an instant, as I teetered on the edge of wakefulness, I noticed that Starling had not spread her blankets by mine. She sat on her blankets on the other side of the room. By Nick. Heads together, they spoke softly about something.
She laughed. I could not hear the words she next said, but the tone was a teasing challenge.
I almost felt a pang of jealousy. I rebuked myself for it. She was a companion, no more. What was it to me how she spent her nights? Last night she had slept against my back. This night she would not. I decided it was the wolf. She couldn't accept it. She was not the first. Knowing I was witted was not the same thing as confronting my bond animal. Well, that was how it was. I slept. Sometime in the night I felt a gentle groping. It was the barest brushing of the skill across my senses. I came alert, but still, waiting. I felt nothing. Had I imagined it, dreamed it? A more chilling thought came to me. Perhaps it was Verity, too weakened to do more than reach for me. Perhaps it was Will. I lay still, longing to reach out and fearing to. I wanted so badly to know that Verity was all right. Since he had blasted Regal's coterie that night, I had felt nothing of him. "Come to me," he had said. What if that had been his dying wish? What if all my seeking would yield me were bones? I pushed the fear away and tried to be open. The mind I felt brush mine was Regal's. I had never skilled to Regal. Had only suspected he was able to skill. Even now, I doubted what I sensed. The strength of the skill seemed Will's, but the feel of the thoughts was Regal's.
"And you have not found the woman, either?"
The skilling was not meant for me. He reached for someone else. I grew bolder, venturing closer. I tried to be open to his thoughts without reaching for them.
"Not as of yet, my king."
Burl, hiding his trembling behind formality and courtesy. I knew Regal could sense it as clearly as I could. I even knew that he enjoyed it. Regal had never been able to grasp the difference between fear and respect. He had no belief in a man's respect for him unless it was tainted with fear. I had not thought he would extend that to his own coterie. I wondered what the threat was that he held over them.
"And nothing of the bastard?"
Regal demanded. There was no mistaking it now. Regal skilled, using Will's strength. Did that mean he could not skill by himself? Burl steeled himself.
"My king, I have found no sign of him. I believe he is dead, truly dead this time. He cut himself with a poison blade. The despair he felt at that moment of decision was absolute. No man could have pretended it."
"Then there should be a body, should there not?"
"Somewhere, my king, I am sure there is. Your guards have simply not found it yet."
This from Carid, who did not tremble with fear. He hid his fear even from himself, pretending it was anger. I understood how he might need to do that, but doubted the wisdom of it. It forced him to stand up to Regal. Regal did not appreciate a man who spoke his mind.
"Perhaps I should put you in charge of riding the roads looking for it,"
Regal suggested pleasantly.
"At the same time, you might find the man who killed Bolt and his patrol."
"My lord king,"
Carid began, but—
"Silence!"
Regal overrode him. He drew freely on Will's strength to do it. The effort cost him nothing.
"I believed him dead once before, and my trust in the word of others nearly got me killed. This time I will see him. See him hacked in pieces before I rest. Will's feeble attempt to trap the bastard into betraying himself failed miserably."
"Perhaps because he is already dead,"
Carid ventured foolishly. Then I witnessed a thing I wished I had not. A needle of pain, hot and piercing, he sent to Carid with Will's skill. In that sending, I finally glimpsed the whole of what they had become. Regal rode Will, not like a man rides a horse to be thrown by the horse in anger, but as a tick or a leech bites into its victim and clings and sucks life from him. Waking or asleep, Regal was with him always, had access always to his strength, and now he spent it viciously, caring nothing for what it would cost Will. I had not known pain could be inflicted with skill alone. A numbing blast of strength such as Verity had spent upon them, that I knew. But this was different. This was no show of force or temper. This was a display of purest vindictiveness. Somewhere I knew Carid fell to the floor and thrashed in wordless agony. Linked as they were, Burl and Will must have shared a shadow of that pain. It surprised me that a member of the coterie was even capable of doing that to another. But then, it was not Will who sent the pain. It was Regal. It passed, after a time. Perhaps in reality it only lasted an instant. For Carid, it certainly lasted long enough. I sensed from him a faint mental whimpering. He was capable of no more than that just now. I do not believe the bastard died. I dare not believe it until I've seen his body. Someone killed Bolt and his men. So find his body and bring it to me, whether alive or dead. Burl! Remain where you are and redouble your efforts. I am certain he is bound that way. Let no traveller pass you unchallenged, Carid. I think perhaps you should join Burl. An indolent life does not seem to agree with your temperament. Be on your way tomorrow, and as you travel, do not be lazy. Keep your minds upon your task. We know that Verity lives. He proved that to all of you, most effectively. The bastard will try to get to him. He must be stopped before he does so, and then my brother must be eliminated as a threat. These are the only tasks I have given you. Why cannot you do them? Have you no thought for what will become of us should Verity succeed? Search for him, with skill and men. Do not let folk forget what I have offered for his capture. Do not let them forget the punishment for aiding them. Am I understood?
Of course, my lord king, I shall spare no effort.
Burl was quick to reply.
Carid? I hear nothing from you, Carid.
The threat of punishment hung over them all.
Please, my lord, I shall do all, everything, alive or dead, I shall find him for you, I shall.
Without even an acknowledgment, Will and Regal's presence vanished. I felt Carid collapse. Burl lingered a moment longer. Did he listen? Did he grope back toward my presence? I let my thoughts float free, my concentration dissipate. Then I opened my eyes and lay